Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
Well, deli food is theoretically something you can get at fast food chains and supermarket counters these days, but the true experience of a genuine Jewish delicatessen is something else entirely. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. For American Jews in and around New York City, the deli at its height was a place that felt both special and deeply familiar somehow, a source for foods that reminded them of their old country grandparents. And yet, most first-generation immigrants couldn't afford to eat out at delis. So it was their children, enjoying hard-won prosperity after a generation in the U.S., who made the deli a gathering place on par with the neighborhood synagogue, only to leave it behind as these newly affluent sons and daughters of immigrants struck out for the suburbs. Ted Merwin is Associate Professor of Religion and Judaic Studies at Dickinson College. He chronicles the rise, fall, and hipster renaissance of the deli in his new book, Pastrami on Rye, An Overstuffed History of the Jewish Deli. Ted, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
What was your relationship to the delis of your childhood?
I actually went to delis quite frequently, or I should say took out from delis quite frequently, a particular deli that was around the corner from my parents' house in Great Neck on Long Island. My grandparents, who lived nearby just across the New York City border in Queens, only ate traditional Eastern European Jewish food. They weren't kosher, but they would have sooner have eaten a slice of pizza or an egg roll as, taken off their clothes and jumped around naked. They just wouldn't have done that. And so whenever they came to visit, which was usually on a Sunday, I was the one who would always be deputized to go around the corner to a deli called Squire's. And it was always the same order that I picked up. It was a pound of roast beef and a pound of turkey and a can of Heinz vegetarian baked beans and a dozen slices of seeded rye bread and a little round squat container of gravy. And I would bring home this bag that had the prices totaled up on the outside with a wax, with a crayon, you know.
Yeah, like grease pencil. Yeah.
With a grease pencil, that's right. And I would come in the front door of my house, and my parents had a small round kitchen table. And I would put the food down on the table. And within 5 minutes, there was not a speck, there was not a morsel, there was not the slightest little shred of food that was left on that table. So even though my family didn't belong to a synagogue, I didn't grow up going to high holidays or to even to Hebrew school. I knew very little about Judaism, but something about that food really connected us to our past and to our ancestors and to our heritage in a way that nothing else could. And what was really ironic about that, though, is that I was telling this story at one point, and somebody said, you know, that's really funny that you were eating those foods. And I said, what do you mean that was funny about it? And they said, well, you said that you were eating turkey and roast beef. And that wasn't the kind of meat that Jews traditionally would order when they went to a deli. Hmm. When Jews went to a deli, they would order pastrami and corned beef and tongue, which was actually my grandmother's favorite food, but not so much roast beef and turkey. And so I realized that what my family was doing was connecting to their heritage in a very American way. And so it was sort of one foot in both worlds. And the more that I started to work on this project of writing this book, the more that I realized that that was really true for my grandparents' generation, for a whole generation of Jews who had perhaps spent some of their childhood on the Lower East Side, but had really moved out of the immigrant ghetto and begun to move into other boroughs of New York City, particularly the Bronx and Brooklyn.
And yet they were still really discriminated against in American society. So they were able to, you know, really celebrate the first flush of their success in America, but they were still the victims of tremendous prejudice in the society at large.
Was there, in fact, anything akin to deli culture in, like, 19th century Eastern Europe, Ted?
You know, that was one of the questions that I first looked into when I was writing the book. I was trying to find the roots of this kind of cuisine in Eastern Europe, and I found very little of that. I found very few references to delis in the records of Jews who had lived in the different communities in Poland and Russia and Lithuania and Hungary and Romania and so on. The only real evidence of it was from some business records that listed delicatessens as combination grocery stores and cafeterias. And then one important piece of evidence, quote unquote, that comes from a very beloved song called Romania, Romania, which is a Yiddish song which was recorded by a very popular song and dance man named Aaron Lebedev, which he sang in the 20s all over the United States and Canada. And in that song, he reminisces about the foods that he loved in his native Romania, even though he actually wasn't from Romania. He sings about the mamma ligula, the cornmeal polenta, the pastramala, the pastrami, the carnazzola, which was sausage, and he said a glazel of wine and a glass of wine. And in each case, he uses the diminutive, the le, at the end of each word, which I think suggests that these were foods that were eaten only in very small quantities and on special occasions. And that's really how they came to be thought of as delicacies.
Despite what the English claim about the Earl of Sandwich, you have found evidence that Jews were the first to discover the delights of wrapping savory meats in bread.
Yes. The Earl of Sandwich invented the name sandwich. But the actual sandwich comes from the Passover Seder, which Jews have celebrated now for 2,000 years. And the idea was that when the temple still stood in Jerusalem, Jews not only ate the unleavened bread, which was the sign of their hasty departure from Egypt, from slavery in Egypt, but also they were able to eat the kind of meat that was sacrificed on the altar by the priests. So that would be probably lamb. Could be ram.
Ram. You don't hear a lot of ram sandwiches these days.
No. It was probably lamb, and it probably wasn't the same kind of unleavened bread that we eat nowadays on Passover, which is the very stiff, crumbly stuff that we call matzah. It was more probably like a wrap.
Like a pita bread kind of thing.
Exactly. Yeah. It was like a lamb and herb, because you had to have bitter herbs as a remembrance of slavery. We usually eat horseradish. So it was a lamb and herb wrap.
Okay, so Jews emigrated to America in very large numbers in the early 20th and late 19th centuries. They, established in New York and places like the Lower East Side, and they put up some delis. But frankly, eating there was not something that most of their neighbors, who in that first generation tended to be quite impoverished, were able to do all that often.
That's right. I remember even my grandmother, who was very much a second-generation Jew, her parents had been immigrants, but she wasn't an immigrant herself. I remember her telling me that eating out was something that they did very, very rarely when she was a child. And I think it just wasn't really much a part of Eastern European Jewish culture, the whole idea of eating out. There's a famous story by Shalom Aleichem, who wrote the stories about Tevye that became the basis for Fiddler on the Roof.
Right.
About a restaurant in Poland, which nobody ever goes to. It's just sort of the proprietor just sits there all day waiting for customers. And I always think of that in this connection. But I think there were a number of reasons why Jews didn't eat out much. I think, for one, it was expensive, as you mentioned, and Jews didn't tend to have a lot of disposable income. I think there were also a lot of concerns that the food would truly be kosher. If you ate food that came from someone else's kitchen or from someone else's store, then you had to worry about whether they took the same care in preparing it that you would take in your own kitchen. And the other thing, I think, is that immigrant Jewish mothers, like other immigrant mothers, really preserved their importance and their role in the family by doing the domestic chores that were expected of them, including cooking. And for a woman not to cook for her family but to take out food from the delicatessen would be to undermine her position in the family.
next generation got over that at least a little bit, and we'll talk about that in a minute. My guest is Ted Merwin. He's Associate Professor of Religion and Judaic Studies at Dickinson College and author of the new book Pastrami on Rye, An Overstuffed History of the Jewish Deli. We'll resume our conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join it at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can take courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Ted Merwin, Associate Professor of Religion and Judaic Studies at Dickinson College and author of the new book Pastrami on Rye, An Overstuffed History of the Jewish Deli. You can join us at 800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. So, Ted, it's kind of a classic American story. First generation of Jewish immigrants really struggled, didn't eat out. Their children struggled as well, but did a little better. But over time, people did have the kind of disposable income, you know, moderate affluence that at least allowed them to eat out. And they were delighted to find these places around the corner that were just, you know, packed to the rafters with extraordinarily delicious foods.
Right. And I think what's interesting is that it took a while for delis to actually become restaurants. I mean, we think of them nowadays, of course, as restaurants, but they weren't initially. They were takeout stores that began in Europe, particularly in Germany and France and Italy and places like that. And actually in France, I've read that after the French Revolution, the former purveyors to the aristocracy, the people who made the furniture and the tapestries and all of the wonderful things that adorned the royal apartments, were all unemployed because their bosses had been decapitated. So they went into the food business and opened food stores and restaurants. And there are historians who say that there were streets in Paris that were covered with nothing but eating establishments and takeout stores. And I think a similar thing happened actually in America, as you just mentioned, that the delicatessen became a place for Jews to really show off that they had arrived, that their social and economic position was rising, and that they had a newfound confidence in themselves and in their ability to really participate in the life of America. As I mentioned a moment ago, there was something that was not quite, I wouldn't say it wasn't authentic, but there was a whole other side to it, which is that Jews really weren't accepted yet in American society. There was tremendous anti-Semitism. Jews were not allowed into universities and professional schools and country clubs and so on. But at least in the New York context, there was still a way in which Jews were very much participating in the economic life of the city in a way that they never had done before. And in the Jazz Age, in the Roaring Twenties, there were opportunities for Jews, especially in the entertainment business, which was a business that had been seen, frankly, as kind of disreputable. I mean, it's one of the reasons why Jews became so successful in Hollywood as well. Because, you know, white Anglo-Saxon Protestants with money didn't want to be making movies. It was seen as something that was kind of scandalous and slightly vulgar. The idea that people were all kind of different social classes were all sitting in the dark watching movies together was something that really frightened people. So in the same way that Jews moved into the movie business, they also very much moved into the theater business. And so the delis that sprang up in Times Square near the Broadway theaters and also near the movie palaces, like, Radio City Music Hall type, cinemas, were, these delis were places that I think Jews really were excited to go to because they were imbued with the glitz and the glamour of celebrity. You know, not only could you see your, you know, favorite star of the stage or screen potentially actually eating in the deli, but the walls were plastered with photos of the celebrities. The sandwiches themselves were named after the actors and actresses, And so I think Jews could feel vicariously as if they were participating in that whole celebrity culture. And I write in the book that they sort of soaked up that atmosphere and that stardust in the same way that, you know, the barrels of brisket were, you know, soaking up the brine to be turned into corned beef and pastrami.
And of course, there was a certain, and remains in the really classic delis, a certain theatricality to the construction of a classic deli sandwich.
Well, there's something that's very theatrical about it. There's something that's very sort of over the top about it. You know, I mean, the whole notion of excess.
Right.
The idea that the sandwich should be so huge, you know, so towering, kind of like I call it the skyscraper sandwich, you know, in the Manhattan context. And so the sandwich became in some ways the symbol for the American dream. You know, I mean, for these Jews for whom meat itself had not been a big part of their culture, particularly in Eastern Europe, and then coming to America and being able to afford meat for the first time and being able to show off how much meat they could purchase and how much meat they could eat, you know, publicly, because restaurants are to this day places where we go to do something in public that we would normally do in private. There's something theatrical about the very act of eating out because it puts us on display. And I think these were Jews who very much wanted to be on display for each other and to some extent for themselves so that they could feel that real feeling of having begun to succeed.
So delis were places for Jews to meet up, to see and be seen, to gather socially. They were also places that sort of invited in the rest of the community, the non-Jewish community, to sample these amazing foods and to recognize that their Jewish neighbors were not so unlike them as fellow Americans.
That's right. I'm especially interested right now in looking at the fondness that African Americans develop towards Jewish delicatessen food and finding examples of that, particularly in Chicago, where there actually was a deli that was owned by a Jewish man that ended up being taken over by one of his African American employees. And so it kind of turned into an African American Jewish deli. It's actually, that deli is actually used as the setting for a famous scene in the Blues Brothers movie, if people are familiar with that, with Aretha Franklin and a big production number. But I think that this was true in general in many cities throughout the country, where African Americans who perhaps were not as comfortable or not as welcome in other kinds of restaurants could actually be seated in a Jewish delicatessen. And that wasn't universally true. I mean, or there were interesting sort of wrinkles on that. I found evidence of one deli in Baltimore where the proprietor advertised that African Americans were welcome as long as they brought their own plates, which I thought was pretty shocking. But certainly because African Americans also had you know, real predilection for very heavy, satisfying food, which they came to call by the 1960s soul food, you know, the delicatessen really offered the kind of Jewish version of soul food. And so it makes a certain amount of sense that African Americans, and a lot of African Americans also had worked for Jewish families, you know, had served as domestic help for Jewish families, had learned to cook from their Jewish, you know, the people who they worked for. And so that might have been part of it as well, that they had come into contact with the food in that way. Then, of course, there's something like, you know, corned beef, which was really an Irish, you know, type of food. We think of corned beef and cabbage. And so Jews took that over from the Irish. But I think there was a borrowing in both directions, you know, that Jews, I mean, actually any type of food that we think of as Jewish now, except maybe for matzah, is a borrowing from a culture in which Jews lived. So, you know, pastrami comes from Romania and gefilte fish comes from Poland. And, you know, pretty much every food that we call Jewish is really something that was adapted from the local cuisine of the country that Jews came from. And then they came to New York, and New York was a place where there was also a lot of back and forth, you know, sort of boundary crossing in terms of culture and in terms of food. And I guess this actually went back to the time of the of the Native Americans and the first the pilgrims and the settlers, you know, where they would eat each other's food that we celebrate on Thanksgiving. But in the sort of 20th century urban context in New York and other places, you know, I think ethnic groups very freely sampled each other's foods. So it made sense that the delicatessen would be a place that, you know, would not just be catering to Jewish clientele, but there would be other people as well who would want to participate in that experience. And I think in terms of Judaism, it was also a place where, you know, non-Jews could get a kind of entree, no pun intended, into Jewish religion and Jewish culture in a way that was a lot more comfortable than walking into a synagogue, for example, where, you know, it was in a foreign land, it was in Hebrew, and the rituals were unfamiliar. But Delhi was a place where people could sample Jewish culture in a very relaxed and friendly and comfortable way.
You mentioned earlier that your parents, you and your parents lived in Great Neck, which for people who don't know is kind of an affluent suburb of New York City. Your grandparents were still in Brooklyn. This is really emblematic of that shift to the suburbs that, that people made over time. And this was good and bad. It wasn't so great for the life of the deli, which at its height is really something that people associate with, you know, finding just around the corner as opposed to picking up and getting into the car and driving to.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I really see the corner kosher deli as very much the cornerstone of the outer borough neighborhoods that Jews moved to when they left the Lower East Side. And as I mentioned, they moved to places like Brownsville in Brooklyn. They moved to the Grand Concourse in the Bronx. And by the 1930s, there were 1,550 kosher delis in the five boroughs of New York. That's an incredible number. I mean, especially at a time when there was so much economic suffering and strife, that the delicatessen was the place where Jews found the kind of community that they needed in order to survive through the Great Depression. But after World War II, and World War II was actually very important because World War II was a time when a lot of Jewish soldiers explored or found out about other kinds of food that they hadn't known about before, particularly for those who were serving in Asia, you know, learning about Asian cuisine, which many of them had never encountered before. And they weren't able to keep kosher, and they weren't able to eat the traditional foods. I mean, that's one reason why this slogan at Katz's Deli and other places, "Send a salami to your boy in the army,"
right,
developed. You know, because you have to say it with an outer borough New York accent or it doesn't sound right. It doesn't rhyme.
Send a salami to your boy in the army.
Send a salami to your boy in the army.
Right.
Because Jews who were serving overseas really craved a taste of home. Hmm. And then they came back, and the landscape was very much transformed. You know, as you mentioned, Jews and other groups moved to the suburbs thanks to the GI Bill and the federal home loan guarantees from the government. And suddenly the deli wasn't a place that was, you know, just around the corner, but you had to get in the car and drive to the shopping mall. And delis really closed in droves. The food didn't go away. The food began to be sold in supermarkets. But it wasn't the same. It wasn't fresh. It wasn't hot. It wasn't, you know, the same kind of quality. But it was seen, at least by some, as, you know, who had come through the war, as you know, as a substitute, as an acceptable substitute, because of the fact that the packaging technologies that were developed during wartime, the freeze drying and the shrink wrapping and all that kind of thing, were applied to food. And in the 1950s, in the typical suburban kitchen, you know, with the beautiful refrigerator and the freezer and everything, there was an idea that this sort of space-age food was actually the best, most advanced, most technologically exciting kind of food that you could eat. So there was a romance, actually, of packaged food. And it's ironic to me because this was food that the whole idea of delicatessen food is that it's been preserved. The whole reason why you cure it, why you brine it, and why you smoke it is to keep it from spoiling. That was how this kind of food was first, you know, developed. And so to take this food, that the definition of which is that it's been preserved in some way, and then to repackage it, I think was a way that, in a sense, Jews were kind of repackaging themselves, you know, for entry into American society, and not wanting to seem so foreign and so alien, but kind of wanting to seem just like everybody else in the 1950s, which was very much an era of kind of consensus and conformity and sameness, and everybody's going to get along together, and, you know, our religions aren't actually that different from one another after all. And that was what Jews used in order to be able to really integrate into American society.
Ted Merwin is my guest, Associate Professor of Religion and Judaic Studies at Dickinson College and author of the new book, Pastrami on Rye, An Overstuffed History of the Jewish Deli. And we'll be right back with Ted Merwin.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can take courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Associate Professor of Religion and Judaic Studies at Dickinson College, Ted Merwin. His new book is called Pastrami on Rye, An Overstuffed History of the Jewish Deli. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Ted, as Jews and other second and third generation, you know, immigrant children moved out to the suburbs, they wanted to experiment with different foods. What did you learn about the Jewish affinity for Chinese food in particular as deli started to fall a bit out of favor and Chinese takeout became like all the rage?
Yes, that started at a place called Bernstein's on Essex on the Lower East Side, which introduced a Chinese menu just once a week, and it was so popular that they started offering it more and more until it became a regular part of, you know, you could have it every time that you went there. And it was actually a kind of combination deli Chinese restaurant where the food was served by Chinese waiters wearing tasseled skull caps. And it really caught on, and I think it caught on for a number of reasons. There's actually been quite a bit of scholarly research into this over the last several years, believe it or not. And it seems that there are similarities between Jewish and Chinese food. There's no dairy. That's part of Chinese food in the same way that Jews don't traditionally mix milk and meat together. And there's a similarity of flavors in terms of both having kind of sweet and sour, you know, tones or notes. There's also, I think, for Jews, as we said before, the fact that Jews really wanted to feel like they were important. And the Chinese were lower on the socioeconomic totem pole than Jews were, even into the post-war decades. And so Jews could go to a Chinese restaurant, and the food there was so chopped and diced up into little pieces that even if Jews were eating pork, they could kind of pretend that they weren't. It also had a lot of sauce on it. So a couple of professors at Queens College came up with this term, safe traif. So traif means food that's not kosher,
right,
and this was food that could be safely eaten. There's this idea,
you had plausible deniability.
Exactly, that if you don't know that you're breaking the law, then you're not responsible for sinning. And I've heard there's also a saying that in Yiddish that a rabbi said that if you're going to sin, you might as well sin until the food kind of runs out over your beard. You know, you might as well enjoy it if you're gonna go for it. And so I think there were lots of reasons why Jews gravitated to Chinese food in particular. There were other cuisines that they enjoyed. I mean, certainly a lot of Jews also began to appreciate Italian food. But Italian restaurants were different from Chinese restaurants. Italian restaurants tended to have very Christian pictures up on the walls. Italians, I think, were a lot scarier in certain ways than Chinese were. There were certainly a lot of associations with Italians and mafia and gangsters and things like that, which Jews had actually been also associated with earlier in the century. But by the post-war decades, they were shedding those kinds of associations. So Chinese food was comfortable, exotic. You know, Jews could pride themselves on being cosmopolitan, that they were eating in these places that were, you know, sort of redolent of the Far East. And so Chinese food became a good substitute for, you know, the kinds of foods that Jews had called their own, but that were, you know, really seen in the years after the World War II as being very immigrant, peasanty, low class, you know, ghetto. They wanted to be middle class, and eating those kinds of foods did not make them feel middle class.
What do you make of chain sandwich places like Quiznos and Panera Bread? I mean, you can eat the food there, but it seems like a stretch to even compare them to an old school New York deli.
Right, but it's interesting how I think they use a lot of the same kind of advertising techniques or the same kind of associations. I mean, you see right now Subway is running this big promotion of the corned beef Reuben, you know, which is this huge overstuffed corned beef sandwich. And I think the idea of the overstuffed sandwich is one that, as we said, really represented American cornucopia and abundance and the American dream. And these fast food restaurants are still promoting that. The idea that you can have so much food for such a relatively low amount of money is something that Americans to this day really pride ourselves on. And so it makes sense that they would be taking these kinds of meats that now are no longer really Jewish in the way that they once were, in the same way that bagels are now as American as, I was going to say apple pie, but that's not quite right. Wonder Bread or white bread?
Yeah, they're like in every supermarket anywhere in the country.
Yeah, and so millions of Americans wake up every morning and eat a bagel for breakfast and don't have any Jewish, you know, don't feel any Jewish connection to it necessarily. But when Jews sit around on a Sunday morning and have bagels and cream cheese and lox, then they can still feel like they are doing something that connects them to their childhood. So to some extent, it's a question of the context. And this is something that I really thought a lot about and wrote a lot about in writing my book, that the food itself in some ways is less important than the context in which it's consumed. And so Jews really turned these eating places into secular synagogues, into places where they could celebrate, you know, their sense of community and their heritage in a secular way. And that's not to say that the food was besides the point, because it wasn't, but that, you know, the feelings and the thoughts that we have and the memories that we have about food are just as important as the food is.
And of course, today there is like this hipster foodie deli renaissance. Can you talk about how these places are borrowing from classic Jewish deli traditions and what the most notable divergences are?
Well, I think that is very interesting that you have places like the Mile End Deli in Brooklyn, like Wise and Sons in San Francisco, like Saul's in Berkeley, General Muir's in Atlanta. You have these newer delis that are presenting the, you know, sort of new takes on traditional Jewish food, you know, coming up with all kinds of new recipes, but also trying to marry the Jewish tradition with, you know, the modern values of sustainability and ecological responsibility, so that they tend to serve smaller portions and they tend to have grass-fed beef and organically grown vegetables and, you know, soda that's not made commercially but that they make themselves. So everything is very artisanal and homemade and so on. And there's a real question about whether or not that's what people are looking for when they go to a deli. I think probably Jews, when they go to a deli, for the most part, are looking for something that reminds them of their childhood. They're going for nostalgic reasons. Mm. Non-Jews are not going for the same reason. Non-Jews are going, you know, because it's the kind of food that appeals to them and the kind of flavors that maybe they don't encounter in other kinds of cuisines. So from what I can see, most of these delis have a majority of non-Jewish customers, and that may be the future for the deli in some ways. And I think that may be the future for Jewish culture writ large in American culture, in American society, that so many Jews are actually pulling away from a lot of, you know, certainly religious customs and rituals. and non-Jews are embracing them. I'm actually writing a book now about, you know, the non-Jewish interest in Jewish, you know, religion, particularly Passover Seders that now are becoming popular in churches all over the country.
Wow.
And I wonder if, as Jews are in some sense turning their back on their own heritage, if that isn't making these things available to sort of float around and be picked up by non-Jews and transformed in their own image into whatever they want to make of them.
Ted Merwin is Associate Professor of Religion and Judaic Studies at Dickinson College. His new book is called Pastrami on Rye, An Overstuffed History of the Jewish Deli. Ted, it's been a fascinating conversation. Thank you very much for making this time for us.
Thank you so much. It's been my pleasure.